Hello and welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love to talk about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we're talking John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982.
All right, here we are once again. Thank you guys for joining us. Cesar, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, CJ. How about you?
Doing all right, yeah. Loving this November California weather. Not to gloat, you know, in front of the people who are over in the East Coast, but yeah. What's today? Today's what, November 12th?
It's a Monday. I guess it's the 12th, yeah.
Yeah. And it's going to be like almost 70 degrees here today, so.
Oh, yeah? Going to be like 41 degrees today.
Yeah, well, that's why I moved. that's one of the reasons I moved.
Yeah.
It was a benefit of moving.
Our mutual friend Matt, he's in Toronto right now.
He is. Have you talked to him recently? I've been texting him back and forth. He's having a good time.
He mentioned that it was very cold up there.
Yeah. And you know Matt, he wears like 6 coats.
You know, I just imagine that he does that in the summertime, and then when it's actually winter, he just, like, reverses. Like,
he wears nothing, bare-chested.
Just wears a tank top or something.
Tank top flip-flops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His body adapts.
No, I don't know if he'd appreciate us, giving out his information or whatever, but our buddy Matt used to work at a local theater chain near us, and now he's working for IMAX, which is very exciting. So, good for you, Matt.
Yeah, we love you, man.
Yeah. Make sure you come back from Canada, though. It's cold up there.
He is. That's just the training, I imagine.
People are nice, though, right?
They are.
Yeah.
I guess you have to be if you're going to be stuck indoors with people in a frozen tundra wasteland.
Well, you have family in Toronto, so you're back and forth to Canada like once or twice a year, right?
Maybe at best once a year, but I love Toronto. I spent a lot of time there as a kid. That's pretty much the only area of Canada I've really been to. I've gone to Niagara Falls as like a young tourist, but Toronto is pretty much the only part of Canada I have any familiarity with.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Canada, our topic of conversation today, most of it, or not most of it, but a lot of it was shot in British Columbia near the Alaskan border. So, boom! John Carpenter's The Thing! Transitions are my strong suit, so.
This movie really makes me feel cold.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we get to that, as is customary with our conversations, typically... what have you been watching? Anything good you want to recommend anybody?
I guess I've been watching a little bit of everything. I've definitely taken a step back from horror films, except for The Thing, because we were going to be recording. I saw pretty recently, and I actually do have a written review up, Blade of the Immortal, directed by Takashi Miike.
How was it? The trailer looked pretty gnarly.
I think the movie itself is quite a bit of fun. It's based on a manga written by Hiroaki Samura. And it's a samurai period piece, but with a lot of pulp sensibilities, ultra-violence, and a revenge story centered around some supernatural elements. Basically, the main character is a warrior named Manji, who has been infected with these things called bloodworms. Along with a curse, the bloodworms heal him from any wound his body receives. The curse compels him to kill 1,000 evil men in order for him to find a way to die. So he comes and meets a young girl named Rin, whose family has been killed by a group of powerful swordsmen, and they team up to, I guess,
take him down,
mark some, you know, get rid of some notches on his belt, and make a hole in that 1,000. So nice. He's basically kind of like a samurai Wolverine.
Yeah. The trailer made it look like it was a little bit gruesome. Is it gory a little bit?
Oh, yeah, very much so. There are two particular battle scenes one at the very beginning of the film, where you see the main character, Manji, played by a guy named Takuya Kimura, who's been in a handful of films that you may have seen. He was in 2049 by Wong Kar-wai, Space Battleship Yamato. He's one of the biggest stars in Japan, period, I'd say. Where he fights around 100 people at the beginning of the film. And then there's another battle towards the end of the movie where there's probably a 300-person army standing against him.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a lot of bloodletting, a lot of, like, severed limbs. And it borders on, like, the grotesque a little bit, but it still stays cartoony enough to its roots that it's not like, disgusting, but it is pretty ultra-violent.
Cool. I'm sure that's actually, a drawing point for many people.
Yeah. If you like Takashi Miike, I think you kind of know what to expect. I find that he was more well-known early in his career for how outlandish a lot of his movies are.
Yeah, like Ichi the Killer, right?
Yeah, elements of that are still present in this movie. But I'm really impressed with how he's kind of pulled back and become a much more restrained director. Now, this isn't exactly like high drama, but it's still a far departure from a lot of other movies where he uses samurai swordsmen.
Cool. Sounds good, man. I'll have to check that out if I can.
Yeah. I caught it theatrically, but I believe it's now available on demand, so you might be able to check it out. Magnet Release, I believe, puts it out.
Nice.
How about you? What have you seen recently that you've enjoyed?
Well, a lot of stuff. I went back and rewatched. Last week I watched a lot of comedies for some reason. So, I rewatched Police Academy. I rewatched.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, I rewatched Trading Places. I rewatched Silver Streak, which is one of my favorite movies.
I think I still have your DVD, and yeah. I still haven't watched it.
That's okay. It was on Netflix, so anybody who wants to watch a terrific Hitchcockian comedy thriller starring Gene Wilder and Jill Clayburgh and Ned Beatty and Richard Pryor and Sir Patrick McGowan, Ray Walston, just a ton of great actors, you should check out Silver Streak. It's amazing.
Ned Beatty,
yeah, he plays Bob Sweet. He's a sweet man, but a mean baby.
Okay.
That's what he says in the movie.
I don't get that reference yet. I know he's in our scheduled next podcast, though.
He is. We'll talk about that later, definitely. But yeah, Silver Streak, it's one of my favorite movies because I'm such a huge Hitchcock fan, and I love North by Northwest with Cary Grant, and Silver Streak kind of takes that whole Hitchcockian wrong man or ordinary guy caught up in unusual circumstances and does it better than a lot of the other movies that have tried to recreate that kind of formula. I actually rewatched recently The Man with One Red Shoe, which stars Tom Hanks in a very similar kind of he's like a concert violinist who gets caught up in an international plot. And that movie just doesn't have any, Belushi and Carrie Fisher and a few other people are in it, but that movie for me does not capture the spirit or the fun or the tension of what Hitchcock would do when he would make movies similar to that. But for me, Silver Streak totally does. And it was directed by Arthur Hiller, and it's set on a train, obviously, the Silver Streak. And so you get a lot of, like, claustrophobic-type scenes, even though it's a comedy. You know, narrow hallways in the train, and, he gets...
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Did you watch Silver Streak because Murder on the Orient Express came out recently?
Well, it was not specifically. To be honest, after we talked about Young Frankenstein, there were two.
Want to watch more Gene Wilder.
There were two things I wanted to do, and one was watch Gene Hackman movies, and the other one was watch more Gene Wilder movies.
The genes.
Yeah, and Silver Streak was a happy coincidence because, you know, you have my DVD, but it happened to pop up on Netflix as a suggestion. And with Murder on the Orient Express coming out soon, it sort of satisfied my, you know, the idea of having a train movie and the idea of watching more Gene Wilder. And it's just terrific. I don't want to babble on too much about it, but... Blabble or babble. I don't want to do any of those things. Too late. But it's really great. Gene Wilder's hilarious, and our friend Jason Swoboda and I both love... There's a particular moment in the movie where he goes to the sheriff of a small town to report a murder on the Silver Streak, and... The sheriff doesn't believe him, and he's a wanted man. They frame him for the murder, and the sheriff pulls a gun on him, and Gene Wilder gets really pissed off, and he calls him a stupid, ignorant, son of a bitch, dumb bastard. And Jason Swoboda always, like, he references that whenever we get together all the time.
Oh, so that is that a pretty good insult?
Yes, son of a bitch, dumb bastard. Yes.
It's very similar to a couple of, like, his outbursts in Young Frankenstein.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, one of his, I guess his signature comedic, you know, touches is that he has, you know, those outbursts constantly. So, but that makes the softer stuff really more meaningful. Like, I think, you know, there are scenes in Willy Wonka and there are scenes in Silver Streak where you really, like, Gene Wilder is just like a very... soft-spoken, charming man a lot of times too, and that dichotomy, you know, those two warring sides of him is what I find so interesting about him as a performer.
Yeah.
So watch Silver Streak. I guarantee that you will like it. It's great.
Yeah, I have no reason to doubt you on this.
Well, for you and for our listeners.
Yeah.
So if you watch Silver Streak and you like it, drop me a message or put a comment on this and, you know, let me know what you thought.
Well, or we could discuss it next time we record.
Maybe, yeah.
We'll see.
One of the other movies that I saw, which I don't want to talk too much about, was Murder on the Orient Express. You know, the Kenneth Branagh version. And the one thing that I'll say is that. If you've seen the 1974 version, I think it's 74, the Sidney Lumet one, you've seen the better version.
Well, I've actually read that story before, too, so...
Yeah.
I don't... like, zero interest in watching this new movie.
The new movie's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, and I don't want to spoil... You know, whether or not they change the ending or not. So if you want to see it, go see it.
That's the reason I don't want to watch it, because I already know the ending. And if they change the ending, I'm just going to be angry.
Well, what if they made the ending better?
Well, it doesn't sound like they did, based on what you just told me.
No, they did not. Branagh's the only performer that really has any sort of, like, life or levity to him during the movie. And his mustache is certainly the best special effect in the film.
Oh, yeah.
It's a doozy of face bush. It's amazing.
Any chance of his mustache getting nominated for best makeup?
Yeah.
Is it, like, up there with, like, Nicole Kidman's nose?
It's up there maybe with, like, Wes Bentley's facial hair from, like, The Hunger Games. Like,
oh, okay. Oh, that's, you know.
It's really funny.
Manicured facial hair.
I don't want to just keep talking about other movies besides The Thing, but I rewatched Police.
He's got good mustaches.
This week was a happy coincidence of movies that just sort of connected in certain, like, little ways. And I rewatched Police Academy, which I said earlier, and the captain, I can't remember the actor's name, but I think it's Captain Reed, the guy who's friends with Mahoney's father and forces him to go into the Police Academy, has an amazing mustache. And all I could think about was that I watched Murder on the Orient Express that afternoon. And then that night I chose to watch Police Academy, and both films had like just amazing killer mustaches in it.
We're going to have to do like maybe do a poll or have a discussion about what are some of the best facial hair in films. We'll see what kind of interesting stuff our readers have and listeners have for us.
I don't know. That stuff just doesn't stick out in my mind most of the time. You know, I mean.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but whatever. Hey, if people have anything interesting to say about it, more power to them. Go for it.
Yeah. We'll see. I'm actually gonna make a post about that, so there you go.
Awesome. Well, let's you have anything else you want to talk about before we transition into The Thing?
No, I really want to talk about The Thing.
Well, I want to thank everybody, first of all, for voting in our poll, and I want to apologize for not getting this out by Halloween, sincerely, because originally we were going to do this, and we chose to do Young Frankenstein first, which was my suggestion, because we thought we still could get a recording in for The Thing and get it out on Halloween, and our schedules kind of fluxed a little bit, and we didn't get it done, and I apologize. But I'm really happy that you guys made me watch this movie again, and I'm glad we get to talk about it. And I really, especially on this one, because you guys voted for it, I really want you guys to get serious in the comments section and tell me what you love about this movie, what you don't like about it maybe, what performances, what grosses you out the most, because I'm really interested, because this is not the movie that I voted for. But I love this movie, so like I'm not disappointed. But
so you guys know, I did vote for this one.
I know you did. So anyway, so thank you, and we're sorry. And here's our conversation on The Thing.
For Halloween, you guys got Tale of Two Sisters and Young Frankenstein. So I think that's an okay exchange.
Yeah. So take what you got and shut up.
Yeah, The Thing's pretty timeless, so I think it's fine whenever we get to it.
Yeah, it's a winter movie, and it's November, so there you go. It's got a lot of snow in it. It's cold.
Yeah, it's cold here.
It's got ice.
East coasters.
That's right. All right, so Cesar, what's The Thing about?
Well, The Thing is an adaptation of a novel or short story.
A novella, yeah, short story.
Written by John W. Campbell Jr., called Who Goes There? A story which I have never read, but was adapted previously in 1951 by Howard Hawks as the film The Thing from Another World, starring
James Arness as The Thing.
Yes, James Arness.
Yeah, he was the monster.
Yes.
Later to go on to great fame as the star of the Gunsmoke TV series.
Which is something I never really watched, but nice tidbit there.
Yeah. Well, they wanted John Wayne for Gunsmoke, and John Wayne was friends with James Arness, and he wasn't 100% sure he wanted to do television. He wanted to keep doing movies. So he told the producers they should hire James Arness instead, and they did. So James Arness has John Wayne to thank for the biggest role of his career.
Did you watch Gunsmoke while it was on the air?
Not a lot. I was more of a Bonanza guy.
Yeah.
So, but
I don't think there are really many Westerns that were on that I remember watching when I was younger.
No, I didn't watch Big Valley and Bonanza. I remember watching occasionally. Like, I didn't watch either of them a lot. But I knew the characters, and if I caught an episode here or there, they were... It's not like television today for any of you who... I don't know, but for any of you who don't, TV episodes used to be sort of like self-contained stories, and they were basically things by design that you could miss an episode and come right back and still be right in the mix of it. And nowadays that's not the case at all, especially with the, I guess what they call the prestige TV shows of HBO and FX and Showtime and things like that, Netflix. But yeah, you used to be able to just watch an episode and skip 10 and watch another episode and everything would be just fine.
The good old days.
Now, I don't know if I can go that far. there was great TV back then, and I don't want to sidetrack this conversation, so maybe we'll parking lot that for a different episode. TV shows are great now, but for a different reason.
That's fair.
Anyway, back to the thing.
So
you mentioned it was based on the short story by John Campbell Jr.
Yes.
Previously made into the 51 version. Have you ever seen it?
I have not, no. Despite the large number of copies we've sold over the years of that.
Yeah, it's really an evergreen title at Suncoast. Like that's a movie that a certain generation of film fans have a real affinity for. When this particular movie came out, John Carpenter's version, a lot of those fans of the classic 1951 movie who had not read the story did not like this movie at all because it's so drastically different from the 51 version. The basic conceit of being in a cold place, isolated, and having an alien monster there is the same. But Carpenter's version is much more faithful to the original story in that it's a shape-shifting creature, whereas in the 51 version, it was just a humanoid plant, essentially. I watched it last week in preparation for this because I was curious and I'd never seen it, and it's considered to be a great classic 50s science fiction movie. And I, to be honest, I thought it was quite good. But I think Carpenter's version is better. And I guess maybe we'll get into some of the reasons why a little bit later. Hang on. My dishwasher beeped.
Oh, see, I thought your cake was done.
I wish I was baking a cake. 'Cause it would smell terrific. Nope. Just cleaning the kitchen this morning.
Oh, okay. That's fine.
Anyway, so I'm derailing you completely, as usual, but you can go back to your synopsis.
Okay. So basically the film is set in an American, scientific research base in right. Antarctica. The American, what would you call them, scientists and employees of the research facility – get a visit from a wolf and a Norwegian man. I'm really bad at this right now.
Yeah, well, you're getting into specifics, but if you want like a synopsis, I guess, you know, 12, I've got one, so I'll just say it.
Yeah.
12 men stationed at a scientific research base on Antarctica come face to face with terror from another world. Their extreme isolation combined with the introduction of an unknowable creature that can take the form of any animal, human or otherwise, creates an atmosphere of distrust and paranoia between the men that inevitably turns into violence.
Sounds good.
Rock. So yes, but you know, the introduction of the, it's an Alaskan Malamute, I guess. It looks like a husky. And the helicopter and the two Norwegians is what kicks the movie off, you know, in earnest. I think the pre-title sequence with the flying saucer feels very dated and unnecessary. Would you agree?
No.
Really? I think the movie would be better without it, to be honest.
It's like Predator or whatever. And
does Predator have a spaceship shot? At the beginning?
Or am I thinking of Predator 2? I think it does.
I don't think Predator does. Predator, they don't even get there forever. Like, they're at the base and like...
Does. But it's like the beginning of... it's like the beginning of the thing. You just see it like an atmosphere shot.
You might be right. I don't remember that, though. It's been a while since I watched Predator, but the thing I remember from the beginning is, Dylan, you son of a bitch. And then they have that epic, like, when they grab arms and both of their biceps are, like, bulging into the camera lens, like...
That's, yeah, it's like the testosterone in that
scene. Oh my god, that McTiernan's the man. We have to do an episode of John McTiernan movies because, like, I mean, obviously the guy's a criminal.
Obviously we need to watch Predator.
But Predator, Die Hard, that guy had a run of movies that I wouldn't say is unequaled, but I would say, like, is on the level with, like, almost anybody. I mean, he did Predator, Die Hard, and The Hunt for Red October, like, right in a row, right?
What year? Die Hard's 88, is that right?
Is it 88? I thought it was 86. I think it's Die Hard and then Predator, right?
Predator's 87. And Die Hard is... Oh, wait. Hunt for Red October is that 1990?
Yeah. 89. Anyway, you know, but McTiernan, that guy can shoot some action scenes.
His movies tend to be a lot of fun too. So
yeah, I even like his Thomas Crown Affair.
You know, I've never seen that one.
Oh, it's really good. That's with the one with Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo and Dennis Leary. Yeah. It's really good.
I've heard good stuff about it. So actually, I think I might actually own a copy of it on DVD. Just never cracked it.
I think it's actually better than the Steve McQueen version. Like, yeah. I would go on record and say that. I think it is a better version.
Okay, well, we're recording, so you are now on record saying that.
I am. It's floating into space right now.
Okay, we got derailed.
Speaking of space, the flying saucer at the beginning of the thing, man. All right, first of all, the effect feels dated.
Okay, that's fine. That's fair.
However, my big thing about it is that you're setting up the audience to know that it's an alien, when I don't think that that's necessary. Obviously, you know, they have their altercation with the Norwegians. The helicopter blows up. Gary shoots the Norwegian, who doesn't die in the helicopter explosion. And then they go to the Norwegian camp. They bring back the videotape. They bring back the crazy two-faced corpse. So you know immediately that something's really, like, off at that point. But you don't know what it is. You know, and I think that mystery would be better served if you don't have the flying saucer at the beginning.
Well, I guess that's fair. I wonder how heavily this movie was promoted, or how obvious they made the connection to The Thing from Another World or the book before this movie was actually released.
Yeah.
Theatrically.
Yeah. I think that's the only thing I can kind of come up with is that, like,
recall seeing like a trailer for this movie.
No,
they didn't make explicit that it was aliens right off the bat, or that.
And to be honest, for this particular movie, I didn't do like a bunch of like behind the scenes documentary research or anything like that, which I usually watch whatever's on the DVD or Blu-ray, but for this one, I just didn't. I watched the movie twice and that was it.
Yeah. Like, I only have a regular DVD, the old DVD of it. I had to get it.
Well, that actually has a feature documentary on it, right?
Not the old one. The one I have isn't, the one I have is just the film.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I had a Blu-ray of it, but we ended up delaying recording because I couldn't find my Blu-ray. But I figured that's an opportunity for me to pick up the new special edition from Shout Factory, which I haven't yet, though, but I guess I need to now.
Little plug for Shout Factory there, though.
High-quality stuff.
We didn't – usually when we start this, I'm like, here's where you can get the movie. But The Thing is available pretty much everywhere. I'm pretty sure it's on Amazon for streaming. You know, it's omnipresent on DVD and Blu-ray. There have been multiple versions. There's currently two Blu-rays available. Three maybe, right? Didn't Arrow just release one?
It was released in the UK, but that's... I guess you could say that release is analogous to the Shout Factory special edition, too.
Okay.
I don't think they have too much different between them.
Yeah, but I mean, to be honest, in most times you can't walk into a video store or a Best Buy or probably even a Walmart without the thing being on the shelf somewhere.
Yeah, I think it's earned. It's kind of a science fiction horror classic moniker.
Yeah, well, I remember, I guess it was 98 when Universal first launched their DVD collection. When DVD was brand new and the players were, you know, incredibly expensive. And I'm pretty sure The Thing was one of the first six DVDs they released.
Yeah. So, do you remember what the other films were?
I don't. But I'm 99% sure that The Thing was one of them.
Saving Private Ryan was probably one of them.
Yeah, they did have DreamWorks back then. You might be right.
I'm curious now. We'll talk about it.
Universal's a comedy studio, or at least has been best known for its comedies during the 70s and 80s. So I would assume maybe Caddyshack was one of them. Or no, Caddyshack's Warner Brothers, right?
Yep.
Blues Brothers. Blues Brothers was probably one of them. Anyway.
Yes.
We're never going to talk about The Thing. We're just going to keep getting sidetracked the whole episode.
Maybe we just need an episode where we just get sidetracked the whole time.
This is it. Anyway, so you I mentioned that I didn't like the flying saucer bit at the beginning. I think we can move past that.
Yeah, let's get to the title sequence.
Well, the actual title, the way that it burns in, is pretty awesome. That's one of the best titles ever.
How cool that is! Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, that comes.
I guess they just have a stencil and paper that they just burn away or something. So.
Yeah. Well, that comes directly from the 1951 film. That's something that they kept from that. And yeah, it's awesome. It's a little bit different from the 51 version, but the idea of it and the font's similar. It's not the same, but it's similar. But, you know, why is this movie such a perennial favorite? What do you love about this movie?
First of all, I love Kurt Russell. He's one of the big things. He plays R.J. McCready, who is, I guess, pretty much the hero of the film. He is mostly our perspective, aside from a couple side POVs that you get interspersed with the film, but he's kind of the guy you follow the whole time.
Yeah.
He's the one guy you kind of feel is never at threat of being taken by the thing. Or right. Being impersonated by the thing. And he's...
Well, they do throw some shade at him, you know, with the torn clothes and the idea that that he's lost out in the snow for a while.
Uh-huh. But he's Kurt Russell. He's Kurt Russell, though, at the time. So.
Yeah, he's the biggest star in the movie. And from what I understand, this movie was reshaped quite a bit during the editing process, and originally it was much more of an ensemble piece and there was no lead because Carpenter wanted to really keep you on your toes and not knowing who you could trust. But it didn't work out as well. So they sort of reshaped it to kind of make it McCready's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So there are points in the film where McCready's sort of not around, and it might seem odd, but that's probably because originally he wasn't, you know, the main character or main POV.
Mm-hmm.
He's awesome though. I love the combination of the leather jacket and the goggles and the I don't know what kind of hat that is, but it's gigantic.
He strikes a figure in this movie. I think this might be. Geez, I don't know. I say this is probably either his first or second most recognized role, I think, in a film.
I don't know. Oh, you mean as far as his most iconic character?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe number two.
I'm not a huge fan of Escape from New York, but I would say Snake Plissken's probably up at the top.
Yeah, I would say that would be number one. But,
yeah.
I feel like MacReady would be his number two, probably.
MacReady's great, definitely. Yeah, you know.
Him and Carpenter, though, they make some memorable characters.
Yeah, well, you know I'm a huge fan of Big Trouble Little China, but I don't want to talk about that because I hope we do an entire episode on it.
Who isn't?
Love that movie.
Okay. So, well, what do you like? Do you like this film? What else do you like about
it? I do like this film. I was, to be honest, I guess confession time, I was a little bit worried that I wouldn't have a whole lot to say about this movie because I do like this movie a lot. But there's something about it that I'm just like, yeah, it's all right. It's solid. I like it. I enjoy it. I watch it every couple of years. But it's not one of those movies that I just love, love, love.
What do you think?
I'm not sure what I would attribute that to. Because there's so much to like about this movie, and it's very solid, and you know, everything from the film craft and the cinematography and the editing and the creature effects to the performances by some of the actors, you know, especially Kurt Russell and Keith David, and you know, everyone loves Brimley in this movie, Wilford Brimley. Mm-hmm. As Blair.
He's got a pretty, like, physical performance in this film, too.
Yeah. They wanted to be us! I love that.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. So, I mean, the thing that I think I like best about it is the atmosphere and, you know, the mistrust and the paranoia of these characters. You know, this is Carpenter's Alien, essentially. I mean, Alien was a huge hit when it came out, and after Star Wars and Alien, and all the studios were trying to get science fiction movies out into the pipeline. And this is a nightmare scenario like Alien, and these are blue collar guys like Alien, isolated from civilization, trapped in a confined space with something horrible like Alien. You know. Something that threatens to infect the rest of humanity should it get into a populated area. I like that it's sort of vague what their jobs are, or if they're even the regular crew. Like it seems like they're there just for the winter. You know, like most of the scientists and whatever they're doing at that base. It seems like they're not there. You know, like during the winter, it's like they shut everything down and go to a skeleton crew and just wait it out until springtime, I guess.
Suppose so.
That's the impression that I get, you know, but I mean, MacReady's a helicopter pilot. The other guy, Palmer, is like the backup helicopter pilot, right?
He's the guy with, like, the cutoff vest or something, right?
Yeah. And then, like, T.K. Carter, who I love from Seems Like Old Times and Hollywood Nights. Uh-huh. He plays Nalls, and he's, like, the cook.
Yeah, he's the roller skater.
Yeah, but we don't really know what Keith David does. I mean, I've heard people say that he's, like, the mechanic on the base. But who knows? You know, what the hell does Charles Hallahan do? The character of Norris. He's not a scientist. He's not the leader. You know, that's Donald Moffat's character, Gary, who I love too. And Donald Moffat is in one of my favorite comedies, underseen comedies from the 80s, The Best of Times with Kurt Russell and Robin Williams. Yeah.
I know you like that film.
Yeah. I love that movie. And Moffat's great in it. But yeah, I like that it's sort of unclear what their roles are there. We're sort of introduced to them during recreation time.
Yeah, you're kind of dropped right into it.
Yeah, so like they're just playing ping pong and poker and drinking and smoking dope.
Playing chess.
Yeah, nothing out of the ordinary. You know, their particular rank or specialties are never 100% clear. Sort of like Alien. You know, like in Alien, you kind of get that there's a hierarchy to the characters. You know, like Tom Skerritt is the main guy. You know, but Ripley and MacReady are sort of like on the same level as far as like they're sort of pushed into a leadership role reluctantly, but become very capable leaders during, you know, their respective movies. So I like that. Kurt Russell's just a female Ripley. That's all. Boom.
You know, if Ripley had a pretty cool mustache.
And a hat. A beard. Not a mustache.
Everything.
He's got a full beard.
So, I agree.
Yeah. So, but anyway, you know, Alien, I mean, they're different movies, obviously, and the shape-shifting nature of the thing certainly brings a different aspect to the thing. Then you get an Alien. In Alien, the humans inherently trust each other. And in The Thing, they, because of, you know,
the paranoia.
The idea that any one of them or even more than one of them could be the creature, there is a growing distrust between them, you know, until a certain point. And then once that creature is revealed, then nobody trusts anybody anymore. So that adds a different element to it.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there's, I think, the first time an audience watches this film, they're right there with the cast members being unsure who to trust, except for Kurt Russell. I think he's, like you said, there's a little bit of shade thrown at him, but I never ever recalled ever thinking in my first viewing that Kurt Russell was anything but
human,
the hero of the movie.
Yeah.
He's the only one I think that's kind of somewhat immune to that.
Well, but when did you watch this movie? When's the first time you watched The Thing?
Probably like 1990, 1991 or so.
Okay.
It would have been around the time the Sci-Fi Channel first became a network.
Okay.
So I want to say 1990, 91.
Yeah, but at that point you were aware of Kurt Russell, movie star though, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, in 1982, people were aware of Kurt Russell.
Well, but yes, that's true. But Kurt Russell was less of a leading man prior to his work with John Carpenter, right?
Well, he'd been in
a bunch of Disney movies as a kid, right? As a teenager?
Yeah. He was the computer that wore tennis shoes.
Yeah, the strongest kid in the world.
Yeah. While Disney died, it was like a dying message.
Make Kurt Russell a star. Okay. Well, I only mention that because, like, I'm not sure people in 1982 would be 100% like, oh, it's Kurt Russell. You know, he can't be the bad guy.
Okay.
I don't remember. I didn't see this movie in the theaters, though.
That was before I was born, so I'll have to defer to the one who was alive at that time.
Mm. Cheap shot. Cheap shot, Alejandro.
Has to come from somewhere, I guess. They're not all gems, okay? Sorry. Well, like, what do you think about one of the things that a lot of people discuss in terms of, like, the horror of this film are, like, the makeup effects and the props and stuff that are in play in this film?
Yeah, Rob Bottin did some amazing work in this movie. And from what I understand, he was incredibly young, like 20 years old or something when he made this film. So it's impressive. And the combination of his work and, Dean Kundi's lighting, Dean Kundi, the cinematographer, really sort of makes, you know, a handful of these really pop, and very memorable. I think some of them are better than others. The Norris monster, I'm not that big a fan of, and the
when he's tied up in the chair,
after his chest cavity opens and becomes a set of teeth and tears the doctor's arms off, which is a great scene. It's like batshit crazy out of nowhere. Like, I can't imagine watching that in 1982 because there was probably nothing like it, you know. So, like, people in the audience were probably, like off the walls crazy when that happened, which, I can't even imagine.
It would have been really fascinating to, you know, maybe hear, like, an audio reaction of the crowd at the time.
Yeah. But, like, after that, like, you know, the how his head comes out of his chest and kind of like is on a like a really long neck and everything. I think those effects are a little bit, because they're so outlandish and so alien looking, I'm not sure they hold up as well as some of the earlier effects work. But yeah, I mean, it looks good. Everything's creative. You know what I like about his work in this movie is that they never do the same thing twice.
Yeah, I think there's such a variety of the creatures. It kind of adds to like the surprise and the unknowing element of it.
Yeah.
You know, it never like comes to life in the same way, which, you know, the characters know and must notice as well. So it's adds, I guess, another level or dimension to that fear to it.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes it's tentacles and sometimes it's teeth and sometimes it's, you know,
spider legs.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, I mean, they do a great job. It's very imaginative. And
it's pretty disgusting too, but I think it's really cool though. I think
it is grotesque. I wrote down like this, not just the creatures that Rob Bottin worked on, but like the suicide victim at the Norwegian camp where he's like tied to a chair and the wrists are slashed with a straight razor.
And his blood's frozen.
Yeah, the blood's frozen before it hits the ground. Like, that's pretty gruesome too. So, I mean, you're definitely going to get your dose of gore with this movie.
Yeah, I think the thing, even to this day, it holds up as some of the more disturbing imagery, I think, in a popular studio horror film.
Yeah, definitely. There's an ambiguity to the plot that I think bothers me a little bit. There's like a Chandler-esque convoluted nature to like to the film. I think once you get to there's three scenes that build like some great tension. Like when Bennings and Waits move the body and then Fuchs and MacReady have their little private conversation in the snowcat about Blair, which reveals that the cellular activity isn't dead and that the creatures are still alive.
Those two scenes, like they intercut with each other, right?
Yeah. And then Windows, the Tom Waits character, discovering Benning's body half transformed in the chair. Like those three scenes work really well together to build tension, but sort of after that, everything gets like it's like a free for all. It's like you can never really know when anybody was assimilated, you know. So like,
why doesn't everyone just sit back to back with each other?
Well, I mentioned that I watched it twice. Like the second time, I was like, I'm gonna figure this out. Like, when did this guy get it, and when did that guy get it? And you sort of have to just give up and go with it,
mm-hmm.
Because you're gonna get frustrated, I think, if you do that. If you have to know, you know, all the specific details.
Yeah, sometimes a movie's just a movie, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I agree, absolutely. And I think there's pros and cons to that. You know, I mean, it can be frustrating if you're the type of viewer who has to know, you know, the specifics and the timeline of a movie like this. But the ambiguity and the unknowable quality, the way Carpenter keeps things unknowable, adds to that atmosphere of paranoia too, though. So I think it's ultimately a benefit for the movie, even though I think it's frustrating personally.
Overall, the thing though is pretty great at creating that tension, though. So I mean, it's a successful film regardless of the methods of it. In terms of like being thrilling, suspenseful,
and it's cool. Flamethrowers? There's flamethrowers everywhere.
Cool.
Why do they need flamethrowers? Is a question that you might ask yourself. I mean, they are in Antarctica, so maybe they use them to like melt ice or something like that. But I mean, like, you know, they have a number of flamethrowers there.
I would assume. No, I don't know this for a fact, but I would assume that like an isolated area, like that small amount of people, it might be necessary for something like quarantine reasons to burn, like if someone becomes ill, it may become necessary to try to destroy anything like that. So
right, or if an alien from another world comes down and infects you.
Yeah, that's right. That's in like page 200 of the handbook
of the Outpost 31 manual.
Yeah, space station 4. Yeah,
it's funny because it like the sign outside the building says that it's a scientific research station 4, but when MacReady is doing his recording on the tape recorder, he says that R.J. MacReady Outpost 31.
And well, they're stationed for Outpost 31. Maybe that's, you know, there are other Americans out there. Antarctica is considered international territory, so people can kind of set up wherever. So maybe station 4 or whatever is just the American, like, area of it, and they're just staking out that one piece of land.
Maybe. I think that's just a movie mistake, personally.
Okay. Okay, you're right.
But I love this cast. I mean, these guys, for the most part, are not big stars. But they're all, like, I mean, a couple of them are dead, but for the most part, the people who are still alive are still working. They're just like character actors.
Yeah, but they're that guy.
Right, but like David Clennon, who plays Palmer, and he's the backup pilot, the guy who has that terrific line, "You gotta be fucking kidding." He was recently in the Vacation reboot and Gone Girl.
You know, I still haven't seen Gone Girl.
Gone Girl's pretty good. I don't think it's one of Fincher's best, but it's interesting. Pretty
good.
Yeah,
I mean, I do own a copy of it. It's a 3-hour movie.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
You know, like Richard Dysart, who played Copper, Dr. Copper. Long career that started in the 50s. He was best known for his role on L.A. Law. Charlie Hallahan was in Twilight Zone the movie, tons of TV shows. He was the captain in the TV series Hunter with Fred Dreyer, which I always liked that one.
Yeah, I recall that.
Yeah. T.K. Carter, who I mentioned earlier, was in Seems Like Old Times. He was also in The Corner. So he's been around for a long time. Wilford Brimley. I mean, Brimley. Brimley's great in this. The China Syndrome, The Natural, The Firm, Cocoon. Hell, that guy's even in that Ewoks TV movie, Battle for Endor.
Yeah, I've never seen that. Let's talk about, talk about Brimley. I really enjoy his freak out with the X in the control room.
Oh, yeah. Brimley, I think, is, he's the one particular case where, I think there's when people talk about the movie and they try to figure out like what the biological, you know, what the thing actually does and how it moves from person to person. And I think the character of Blair, my personal theory is that he's absorbed some of the thing through the blood from doing the autopsy and he gradually becomes a thing. So I think that outburst that he has when he's shooting and they have to go in and take him out, and Kurt Russell gives him like the two punches. I think he's still mostly human there, but I think once they get him isolated, I'm not sure someone goes to there and assimilates him. I think he's gradually assimilated from within.
Sure. Does that make sense? I guess you would assume that sometime after he sets up the noose to kill himself before he turns into that thing, that's the point when he fully transitions into it.
Yeah.
He's pretty great. Pretty great in the movie.
He really is. I like...
Hard to expect that he would show up as a villain, and it's a pretty great finale at the end, too, I think.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's very creepy the way he kind of like just sticks his fingers into the guy's face, Gary's face.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He's like,
you know, I think one of the things I always really liked is like how his thing moves through the ground in kind of like a subterranean tremors type of way. Like,
yeah,
like Russell when he's pull in the stick of dynamite.
Yeah, I mean,
I really like that bit.
Everything is different. Like, you know, that's when Palmer turns into the thing. Well, we didn't talk about the blood test. The blood test scene's like the greatest.
It's one of the classic. It's so jumpy too. Like it's. I think even though I know it's coming, it's still surprising almost every time it does it.
Yeah.
Every time.
Well, I think that's because they do a great thing. The hand that's holding like the Petri dish is a fake hand. And usually you can spot those type of prosthetics like really easily. But what they did, it's a good prosthetic, but what they did was they introduce it into the shot like two shots before that. So like it's there when he, I forget whose blood it is, but when he tests somebody's blood, it's a fake hand and nothing happens. So when they cut back like two or three shots later and he's testing the blood again, and then the blood kind of like squeals and jumps out of the Petri dish. It's very shocking, but it's not funny because like you don't realize because they've introduced that prosthetic previously.
Yeah, your mind has the opportunity to suspend disbelief.
Yeah, you get visually accustomed to it.
Yeah.
So that's one great thing they do in that scene. The other thing is I do think it's funny because every time they test somebody's blood, they sort of like cut to a new person, you know, like he tests Windows' blood and then, you know, Windows helps him out. And then they have, you know, once Palmer's blood reacts to it, you know, they have to burn him, and then he gets Windows. So they have to burn Windows, and then they just slam cut to like Russell, like, with, the TK Carter Knolls. With the flamethrower next to him. So, like that sort of, like, juxtaposition is funny to me.
Yeah, uh-huh. And then you have, what was it, Gary.
Gary's outburst, yeah.
Yeah, in sofa. He's generally pretty rational up until that point, so.
He really is. Like, the scene where he sort of gives up the gun is great.
Personality, or the degradation of, like, their minds up to that point, especially considering what they just saw. Like, yeah, that flamethrower scene during the test is pretty bonkers too. It's intense.
Yeah. And they're still like, Gary and Childs and who's the third guy? I guess it's Knowles. When Palmer turns into the thing, they're still tied to the fucking couch. So he's going crazy and growing bigger, and like the couch is like tipping, and they're all like just screaming and freaking out, but they can't get away because they're just tied to the couch, which is funny, but it's terrifying.
Yeah, it's super memorable. I think there aren't many scenes like the blood testing scene that I enjoy as much in horror films. For me, it'd probably be in like top 10 scenes in a horror movie because it's so thrilling every time I see it.
Yeah, it's really good. And I mean, I've heard people talk about the thing as sort of like analogous to like the AIDS epidemic and the idea that like you don't know who has it and you require a blood test. I'm not sure that any of that was intentional. I think that was just timely.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, who knows though? Unless you ask Carpenter himself.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure he's denied that was in their minds when they made the movie. Yeah, I think it's certainly, you know, being a movie set in 1982, and you know, the AIDS outbreak was still something that really people didn't know a whole lot about. You know, if that's something that people want to, you know, kind of project onto the thing, I think that's fine. But I don't see it as intentional. You know, there are a lot of other early 80s science fiction movies. One particular comes to mind is Naked Sky. Is it Liquid Sky?
It's not one I'm familiar with, though.
Hang on, let me check. Yeah, Liquid Sky. So, which was made the same year, actually, 1982, but it was an independent movie, very low budget. But it's about an alien who comes and preys on drug dealers and bisexuals and people in the modeling world and stuff. So like that one, I think you could certainly attribute as an analogy to AIDS more so than you can The Thing.
Okay.
Right.
So, have you seen that movie, Liquid Sky?
Yes, I was actually saw it a few years ago at the Maryland Film Festival before it got a it got a Blu-ray release this year. But before that, the director, let me see if I can get his name right. I think it's Slava Sukerman. He brought the film around and kind of like toured with his own personal print of it in an attempt to make enough money to do a restoration and get a Blu-ray release. And thankfully he finally did. I actually wrote a print review on that.
On a previous, on Setting the Frame?
Yeah, on Setting the Frame.
I don't remember you posting that, but I guess,
yeah, it's okay. What else about this movie?
I don't know. The movie's pretty straightforward.
MacReady drinks a lot of J&B.
That's Gentleman's Guide approved.
It is. It's very clear that that he's an alcoholic.
That's exactly the kind of like pilot I want.
Right. Well, I mean, well, I think they do a good job of sort of like hinting, you know, like, you know, we did, I guess, for episode 2 of Celluloid Jelly, we did a movie called Sorcerer by William Friedkin. And the men in that movie were sort of, you know, in the butt crack of the world for reasons because they couldn't be elsewhere. They were hiding from something. And you get the feeling with The Thing that these guys aren't criminals, but you get the feeling like they have nothing else. Like maybe they're hiding from something, you know, in their personal lives.
And on a tuna boat or something.
Yeah. And Russell in particular, and it wouldn't be a stretch to say Childs or Palmer too, is an obvious veteran. You know, he's got experience with firearms. He's a helicopter pilot. You know, so that's not something that you get trained for by signing up to go, you know, for a scientific outpost. You have to have that training to get hired for that in the first place.
Sure.
So I think, you know, he probably came home from the war and, you know, didn't know what to do with his life and had only a handful of skills and this is the job he ended up with. And, you know, so he's an alcoholic, which I think is, I mean, he's not like a fall down drunk, but you know, he's a consistent drinker. And a lot of the guys are smoking pot throughout the movie. I love the scene in particular at the beginning when the Norwegians show up and MacReady takes the bottle outside. And so even with like the commotion and the gunfire, he never loses a drop. He actually dives into a snowbank and he keeps like the bottle like the right side up.
Well, I mean, I guess like the J&B is a helpful friend, you know, gets him out of checkmate.
Yeah.
Early on in the movie.
Yeah. Adrian Barbeau's cameo as the voice of the computer program that he plays chess with.
Oh, is that her?
Yeah.
I don't know if I ever knew that.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, I did rewatch The Fog as part of my Halloween horror movies.
Oh, you know, it's been a long time since I've watched that one. And I've seen the remake more recently, so which, you know, obviously leaves sort of a bitter taste in your mouth. So I should go back and rewatch Carpenter's version.
Yeah, I really like The Fog.
Yeah. That was the movie he did right before this, or two movies before this? I think Escape from New York was 81, this was 82, so The Fog was probably before Escape from New York.
Yeah, 1980, I believe. I could be mistaken, though.
Carpenter had a good run.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not all of his films were like massive success right off the bat, but almost all of them have kind of attained cult status in the years since.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Thing specifically, I think, is probably one of the ones that has kind of stood the test of time.
Well, he was not, he's a USC cinema school graduate. So he, like, he came out like a couple classes behind, you know, people like George Lucas. And yeah, his films, I mean, Halloween was a huge success, and, that gave him a lot of room to kind of do whatever he wanted. But he was not considered to be, like, you know, one of the great filmmakers working. And there's been a critical reassessment of that over the last, you know, decade or more. And I'm glad, because a lot of his movies, you know, I really enjoy, even something like Prince of Darkness, which is not one of his best films. For some reason, I really enjoy the hell out of that movie all the time. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Big Trouble in Little China. They Live is certainly a movie that has a lot on its mind, and has that great fist fight with Roddy Piper and Keith David.
Yeah, one of the best on-screen fights of all time.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It goes on forever. But, I mean, you know, Carpenter, I can't remember if I was reading something about this movie or about something different. But I read a quote where he talked about how much criticism affects him, you know, and when his movies are not liked. I can't remember how he phrased it, but, you know, essentially that it's the worst feeling in the world when you spend a year of your life making something and then all people do is criticize it or trash it, you know. And it's a huge hump to get over psychologically for an artist or a filmmaker.
Yeah, absolutely. I think not just a filmmaker, but yeah, you're right. Like any artist having to deal with criticism, and then having to continue on with your job, you know, with the mentality that what you do isn't going to be accepted. That's pretty tough. That can really place a really heavy mental strain on anyone, especially an artist who has to be creative.
Yeah, absolutely.
I tend to really respect anyone who kind of puts themselves out there, even if it's not to my taste. You know, the courage it takes to do something like that, whether it's music or art, filmmaking, what have you, it's always pretty astonishing to me.
Yeah, and I know we've had this conversation many times because it's sort of a running joke that it's always more fun to write a bad review than a good review.
Yeah, it's not more fun, it's easier.
Well, I mean, you can certainly get more colorful with your language sometimes, but but you know, like I think that's something that I would always think twice about doing, you know, because of that, because of knowing that, you know, like, you know, these guys are doing the best they can, and making a movie is a collaborative process, and no matter how good you are, you're relying on so many other people, and when a movie doesn't come together well, you know, it's never that one person's fault.
You know, yeah, that's a message for all you people who hate George Lucas.
Hey, that's a subject for a different, like, that's a much bigger conversation than we're going to get into right now. I have a lot of thoughts about Star Wars fans and Uncle Georgie, and it's best if I don't start sharing them now.
Okay.
But anyway, you know, The Thing, it really is a great film. I enjoy it quite a bit.
You know, it's been a while since I'd seen The Thing, like sat through it from beginning to end. A lot of times over the last few years, I'd see it on and just catch the end of it. But it was nice to go back and revisit it in its entirety.
Well, the ending's great. And again, one of those sort of like downbeat, vague, open-ended type things. You know, are they human? Are they the thing? Is one of them the thing? If they're human, are they basically condemned to die? You know, with the base being destroyed. You know, my personal answer is I don't think anything survives. I know they shot an alternate ending where Kurt Russell gets picked up and they do a blood test and he's not, you know, an alien. He's a human. But apparently that was shot and shelved and never seen the light of day. It's never been on any of the deleted scenes. It was never used for test screenings. And I'm glad, because I think that the ending that Carpenter chooses to go with is truer to the spirit of the film as a whole.
You know, there's a, I don't know if you're aware, but there was a video game.
Yeah, in 2002? Like
It came out early 2000s. I'm not sure exactly what year it was, but that's a game I actually played. John Carpenter actually produced the game, and he even provides a voice, an uncredited cameo, in the game, if I remember correctly. But the game basically is about a special forces team who comes and investigates the base after the events of the film. It suggests that Childs was not the thing. They find his frozen body, and MacReady is nowhere to be found. So that's kind of like the start of the game.
Ah. Is it a good game?
What's that?
Is it a good game?
It is. It does. It has a couple of interesting mechanics, including certain characters of the game. Depending on how well you play it, some people may be infected, though it takes time for them to fully change. But due to the nature of the game, if you play it multiple times, different people will end up being infected instead of the ones you experienced earlier on through your first playthrough.
Okay, that's cool. I know there's been a comic book series too, so.
Yeah, I've never read that though.
Yeah.
A lot of those older books from the early 90s tend to be pretty difficult to get a hold of unless you just happen to find them or search them out specifically.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I don't think I have anything more to say about The Thing.
Well, you know, I guess in summation, I'm a really big fan of the movie. I think I've probably seen it somewhere around 10 times in my lifetime. It's a very enjoyable film. I don't watch it probably nearly as much as I would like. But I think this most recent viewing will probably satisfy me for a while, at least until next year anyway.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I like the movie quite a bit. But having watched it twice over the last 2 weeks, I'm probably not going to watch it again for quite a while.
Well, I don't know. I think maybe if we get a blizzard this year, maybe I'll pull it aside again, just because I like watching movies with a lot of snow when I'm snowed in.
Well, we're gonna watch a movie with some snow in it next week.
Yeah, in the North Pole though, or wait, yeah. Is it North Pole? It's North Pole.
Well, in the Thing from Another World, they're actually in the Arctic, not the Antarctic.
No, it doesn't say Antarctic at the beginning of the movie.
Not in the original one, only in Carpenter's version.
Oh, okay.
Right. In the original 51, they're actually they go from like a military base to a scientific outpost in the Arctic. In Carpenter's version, they're in the Antarctic.
All right.
Which is, you know, I mean, obviously similar landscapes. You know, one of the things that I thought was funny was like the 1951 version. They do a much better job of showing you that the landscape is harsh and that the weather is rough. And in Carpenter's version, a lot of the exterior shots, there's not a lot of snow. It's like crystal clear sky. I mean, there's snow everywhere, but it's not snowing. It's not storming. And I didn't think about it until I watched the 51 version, because they do a better job of like, you know, blowing snow through the frame and making it look much more harsh.
Yeah. The scenes at night in the Carpenter version are still pretty creepy, though.
Yeah. Well, the Carpenter version has the one scene where MacReady gets stuck outside is, like, during a storm. And they talk about how in 6 hours they're going to be in the middle of a giant storm. But for whatever reason, after watching the original one, I was like, yeah, they could have done a way better job of making it look harsh in Carpenter's version.
Well, like that storm that they were gonna have in 6 hours, that happens like quite a bit in the past, because when he's talking on the recorder, that's like a couple days after, right? A day or two after. So the storm would have hit in the past at that point, right?
I don't think that's during the recording scene, is it?
No, but when he's recording, the storm that was 6 hours away would have already happened. So you assume, I think my impression was that at the recording, they'd already been suspicious of each other for at least a day while they were developing the blood test.
Yeah. I don't know the timeline, but like, it seems like they're probably there for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
Like that seems like the right amount of time because they're not sleeping mm-hmm. or at least they're not sleeping much. So that's, speaking of that recording scene though, do you have a theory as to why he goes back and erases what he says?
No, not really. Well, I mean, I thought like he just erases that little bit before he continues on though, right?
Yeah, I wrote it down. He says, nobody trusts anybody and we're all very tired. And he goes back and erases that, and he records over it saying, there's nothing else I can do, just wait.
What was the line just before that?
I don't remember.
It sounds like you have a theory.
Well, it's not a theory, but I think, you know, maybe he goes back and erases it because it seems incriminating that, like, if somebody finds it, maybe they won't trust him. You know, nobody trusts anybody, we're all very tired, it kind of like shows weakness, maybe. And there's nothing else I can do, just wait, seems like, I don't know, like there's more of a perseverance to it, I guess.
Maybe it's, I mean, just thinking about it in this moment right now, I mean, why would he care necessarily what other people think after the fact, if this is supposed to be a record, if he doesn't make it?
I don't know, but he obviously does because he goes back and erases it.
Are you sure he erases that much, though? Who knows how much I mean, he only goes back a little bit, so. But he does, you know, hit stop on the cassette tape.
Well, having had one of those cassette tape recorders when I was growing up... showing my age a little bit there.
Press stop, so that means it goes back a lot farther.
You're right. There's no way to know exactly what he, you know, recorded over, but like that's the implication that he cuts that line out during the scene.
Maybe he just doesn't want he wants people to take this threat seriously. That bit where they don't trust each other. Maybe that would suggest that it wasn't actually something supernatural or alien that caused a disaster, but rather humans themselves that did it themselves. So, I mean, someone could listen to that and automatically make the assumption, oh, this guy went crazy, cabin fever, and this is why everyone's dead and gone.
Maybe. I don't know. I guess that's as good a theory as any.
Maybe. Maybe that's something... might need to see if other people have thought about it.
Yeah. It's also weird that he pulls the fire alarm like when he hears the dogs howl, even though he doesn't know what the hell's going on.
It's just everyone needs attention,
I guess. But like it seems extreme. Like there's no gunfire or anything like that. He just hears the dogs howling. And he automatically like pulls the fire alarm, and that's what gets everybody else up. But he doesn't know what's happening.
Yeah, good thing he did though.
Yeah, I guess so. And he automatically says to get the flamethrower before he sees what's happening, too.
Maybe that's his response to everything.
There's a fire in the kitchen. Get the flamethrower.
There's a blizzard. Stand outside and fight it.
Everybody get a flamethrower. Let's light this camp up. So what are we talking about for next week, Cesar?
We are going to be talking about Superman, specifically the 3-hour made-for-television cut, I'm assuming.
Well, I watched that last night, so yeah. I won't say anything about it specifically, but I think we should just talk about that movie in general, and we can talk about the 3-hour cut, which just came out on Blu-ray from the Warner Archive.
I meant to watch it yesterday, but I did not get around to it for whatever reason.
I'm excited to talk about that movie, and I enjoyed rewatching it. So,
I love Superman, so.
But that's all I'll say.
Okay, fine. Fine and dandy.
Right.
What do you think we should do after Superman?
Oh, I don't know. We should do it. Well, we can talk about that off air.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. We still haven't recorded Superman yet. Let's do that first.
I still haven't watched it yet. So here we go.
Well, you are in for a treat, my friend.
Yeah. Okay. I hope you know what like the differences are between that and the original theatrical cut, because I am unsure.
I watched the. We'll talk about it next time.
Okay. All right. I guess there we are.
But anyway, thank you again to everyone who voted in the poll. I hope, I feel like I didn't say, a whole lot about the movie other than I like it. But I hope you enjoyed.
Only one of us could be right.
I hope you enjoyed Cesar's articulate thoughts on John Carpenter's 1982 thriller, The Thing. And I hope me blabbering around and working my way in circles brought you a smile to your face today.
You gave me way too much credit.
We'll see you next time. Watch Richard Donner's Superman so you can join the conversation. And where can people find you on the internet, Mr. Cesar?
As always, I'm at filmsmash.com, Asian film movie and reviews. I mentioned I did a written review for Blade of the Immortal, which is online now. And I have a couple plans. Specifically, I think there's a movie I'm going to watch this evening called The Villainess, which has been described as a Korean Jane Wick, like as in John Wick, like action film.
Gotcha.
From what I hear, it's to a lot of genre fans, one of the best action films of the year. So cool. I'm excited to check it out.
Awesome.
How about you, CJ? Where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame, or right here at Celluloid Jelly, or on our Facebook page for Celluloid awesome. Jelly.
Yep.
And yeah, that's it.
Cool.
So we'll see you all next week, and have a good one. Watch some movies. Report back to us.
Be kind to each other.
What did Mr. Rogers say every time? You're a special person.
I don't remember. He's a smart guy.
Who right. was Keith David on the Mr. Rogers show?
I'm sure there are a number of people that were on there.
No, I'm pretty sure Keith David from John Carpenter's The Thing was like the handyman for Mr. Rogers. I'm going to Google that.
It's definitely been decades since I've watched Mr. Rogers, but something I did not realize was that George Romero directed episodes of Mr. Rogers.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, in October, I watched a documentary about George Romero and Night of the Living Dead, and he talked about specifically directing episodes of it, and they show clips, presumably from the ones he did have a part in.
Wow. And yes, Keith David was Keith the handyman on Mr. Rogers. That's awesome.
Keith playing Keith.
Playing Keith. So on that note, we're going to get out of here. You guys all have a good one. And Cesar, thank you very much.
Thank you, CJ. It's always a pleasure.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.